Welcome to the Mindspace Podcast. I'm Joe Flanders. Thanks for tuning in. You know, psychedelics are starting to show up everywhere. And while we wait for researchers to produce the data and for lawmakers to reschedule psychedelic compounds for therapeutic use, many people are exploring psychedelics for healing, spiritual growth, creativity, and connection on their own. Now, consuming these compounds does come with some risks. And enjoying the benefits of psychedelic experiences often requires the support of an experienced guide or therapist. For these reasons, the practice of psychedelic harm reduction integration, PHRI or FREE, has emerged as an important element in the psychedelic field. My guest today has an enormous amount of experience with FREE. His name is Andrew Rose. He's a certified mindfulness teacher, formerly the Director of Programming and Digital Strategy at Mindspace, and currently the Director of Programming and Content at Numinous, where he also heads up the FREE program. If you'd like to know more about the FREE programs at Mindspace or Numinous, you can check out the websites, so mindspacewellbeing.com/services/psychedelics, and at numinouswellness.com/services/psychedelic harm reduction and integration. Those links will be in the show notes, obviously. Andrew is a really good friend. We've been working together for a number of years, and it was truly a pleasure to pick his brain for the Mindspace podcast, and I hope you enjoy too. Andrew Rose, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Joe. It's about time.
You've been waiting a long time for this?
Every day.
All right. Well, it's actually really nice to have you here. I agree it's a long time coming. And I think we've had a few warm-up conversations to this one. So
I think a couple.
All right. Let's start off. I know you well, but probably most of the listeners and viewers don't. Tell us about yourself, your background, and how you found yourself working in the psychedelics field.
Sure. So my name is Andrew Rose. I'm from Montreal, born and raised. I have a pretty diverse background, personally, professionally. Actually worked in the music business for a long time in Montreal, but predating that, I've always been interested in consciousness, spirituality, explored and practiced various sort of Buddhist traditions for a long time, starting in my 20s. And my interest in psychedelics even predates that. So over the years, I kind of got closer and closer to, the field that you're in. And we met, I guess, 5 or 6 years ago, or we met much longer ago than that, but connected 5 or 6 years ago when I was moving out of working in the digital space, producing websites and things like that, and just wanted to dive more into mindfulness and that practices in and around that. And that led to our starting presence meditation, so dropping a meditation studio. And eventually joining Mindspace and running all of our group programming, psychoeducation, and then dove a lot deeper into the clinical mindfulness world and got trained as an MBSR teacher in mindfulness-based stress reduction. Yeah, and then the psychedelics piece was always kind of happening in the background, of course. And over the last few years, that's come increasingly to the foreground. Starting a psychedelic harm reduction and integration program at Mindspace, and now with Numinous. I'm sure we'll talk more about that. I'm also I'm the Director of Programming and Content at Numinous, and I'm also an assisting trainer at Fluence, which is an organization that does a lot of training for therapists and clinicians in psychedelics. I also co-run a community organization called Plant Parenthood, which is a digital community of parents who are interested in psychedelics, psychedelic integration, and the intersection of family and intentional therapeutic psychedelic use.
Tell me, you can answer this as vaguely as you want, but Sure. Why are we talking to you about psychedelics? What's your background there, and how do you have the expertise that we're going to hear about today?
I have no idea. hopefully, folks can listen to the rest of the podcast and decide for themselves whether it was a good idea to talk to me or not. Yeah, I mean, I have a lot of deep experience with psychedelics is the sort of simple way I can say that, simple way I can put it. Yeah, going back over 20 years and the experiences ranged from quite recreational and casual. And I'm sure there are lots of folks out there who have similar experience, but certainly sort of deepened and broadened over the years to more sort of therapeutic, again, and intentional relational ways of working with the medicines. I think also just as a mindfulness teacher and practitioner and someone immersed in some spiritual and contemplative esoteric traditions, there's a lot there as well that's complementary to exploring the psychedelic world. But yeah, I like to hear from all kinds of folks about psychedelics. I think one of the really interesting things about the space now is we're really just seeing disciplines from all over colliding, you know, psychiatry, psychology,
neurology. Spiritual
practices, neurology, right? It's really transforming the landscape in terms of how we're thinking about consciousness, well-being, relationship. Hopefully that suffices.
Yeah, I think it does for me.
If your listeners aren't satisfied, I'm sure there's an email they can send complaints to.
So the topic today is psychedelic integration. I'd like to start with the basics, and I'm sure it won't take long before we're into the abstract stuff, but let's start with the basics. What is psychedelic integration?
Great question. Integration to me is really anything and everything you can do to make use of a psychedelic experience that leads to a better outcome for the individual who's had that experience according to, you know, the outcomes they desire and the values they have in their lives. So, you know, in a sort of simple definition would be, well, it's the work you do after an experience to make sure you derive benefit from that experience.
Mm-hmm. That works. That's pretty basic. So one of the words you mentioned is after, and sometimes I wonder if integration actually starts before. Is there something about that we do before that facilitates integration?
Yeah. I mean, you can think about integration happening before as well. And we can, you know, unpack this in more detail for sure. That's what, you know, one of the reasons we talk about psychedelic harm reduction and integration. Another way to think about that is psychedelic preparation and integration. The harm reduction label is a useful framework because, for one, it's kind of an existing modality around and a way of approaching sort of substance use in general and mitigating risks associated with it. And there are risks. But, you know, preparation can also mean how are you just setting yourself up for success so that you go into an experience. You have the best chance of having an experience that can lead to harnessing it beneficially. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you can certainly think about integration happening before. And you know, these things are not, this process is not necessarily linear. You hear a lot about folks who sort of, you know, go into psychedelic experiences with therapeutic intent and, you know, they unpack something on the surface or underneath that they didn't, you know, expect to work through that or discover something. And then something else is revealed underneath that can be, you know, worked on later and you kind of go through the cycle again.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. I thought this might be an opportunity to just define what we mean by free, PHRI. Where does the term come from? Why does it, how does it encompass what you just said and what we're going to be talking about?
You know, psychedelic integration as a concept has been around for a long time. I'm not even sure who would have sort of coined that term, but you know, integration just used in a sort of psychological context, I think is maybe self-explanatory. And again, as I said, harm reduction, also an existing modality around working with substance use. So pairing the two together, I'm not sure where it necessarily started, but I know we started talking about it and abbreviating it and calling it free. PHRI a couple of years ago, and certainly some of our colleagues, Elizabeth Nielsen and Amar Gorman, who run Fluence, published a paper I think earlier this year or late last year on the modality. It's explicitly in psychedelic harm reduction integration and just all the work that is happening on sort of both sides of the spectrum there.
Yeah. Okay. So one of the ways I thought we can kind of dive into this whole thing is to just go through a sort of prototypical psychedelic experience. And we can talk about where the prep and the harm reduction comes in. We could talk about the actual psychedelic journey and then get into the integration process more deeply. So maybe take us through how that typically happens.
A typical psychedelic. Yeah. I'm not sure if such a thing exists.
Dumb question. Yeah.
So sorry, you want to go through the actual experience first?
Yeah. There's certain sort of like typically if people are following the conventions, the extent that there are some around doing a therapeutic psychedelic journey, my sense is usually it starts with some education, collecting information about the compound, setting oneself up with set and setting, with intentions, maybe a guide, etc. Any kind of basic guidelines about how to do that, and maybe even the legalities at this point, because it's still not legal, and yet there's so much evidence about the potential health benefits.
Sure. I mean, it's pretty broad, yeah. Right? And there's a lot of variables there. What substance or medicine are we talking about? What dose are we talking about? What is the person's, mental health profile? Did they have a trauma history? What's their intention? I mean, the first question I would always have is like, what are you hoping to achieve here? If someone would approach me in a harm reduction context, saying, I'm interested in psilocybin. That's really where you start. It's like, why? What's wrong? Or what's right? Right. And sort of building from there. So, I think safety, is really a primary consideration, continues to be. It's interesting because, there's an interesting tension to balance right now on the psychedelic space, because the fact is most of these substances are pretty safe from a physiological perspective. Certainly compared to a lot of other substances, recreational or prescribed, that are consumed regularly by a big chunk of the population, and pretty safe psychologically as well. It doesn't mean there aren't risks, but I think balancing the narrative, like that narrative, with ensuring that people are kind of just, take a few steps going into the experience, is an important one. Yeah. So yeah. What kind of dose are we talking about? If it's a higher, is there previous experience at all, or is this entirely new for someone? If there is previous experience, how long ago was it? What kinds of experiences were had then? What kind of supports do people have in their life? So is there an issue they're really hoping to address, and what is that issue connected to? Is it connected to a relationship? Is it connected to work? Is it connected to one's inner spiritual life? Or is it an explicit kind of clinical condition? Depression, anxiety, addiction, OCD, eating disorder, all these kinds of ways that, difficulties show up and pain shows up in people's lives. And then from there, every answer then will yield a different set of sort of questions you want to kind of go down. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's interesting. These are the considerations that would come up in a meeting with a free therapist or coach, PHRI. So just sort of addressing all these things. And of course, I think, to be responsible here, we would say that we're not condoning illegal activity. But this really is one of the core pieces of the harm reduction framework, which is to say the information's out there, the potential for healing and personal growth and all that is very, very powerful. People are finding these substances on their own, and rather than drive the stuff underground and put people at risk, we are doing our best to help them get educated and make the best decisions for themselves. And that's really, a good chunk of what the free program is about.
That's right. I mean, the context there around harm reduction is that you're not prescribing or suggesting or encourage anything, but you're not necessarily discouraging it either. Right. The same way as if you were a therapist working with someone who had a substance use issue, you wouldn't refuse treatment because they have a problem with cocaine or something.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So I'm noticing you're not making very like hard and fast prescriptions. People should be taking this amount of MDMA and they should be setting this kind of intention and blah, blah, blah. So it's a process. It's useful to talk to someone about it, work out these things, and you've sort of identified some considerations or questions to kind of get into in the prep phase.
Yeah, and you know, it is like the harm reduction and the preparation piece really is more more kind of educational, right? There is information out there based on all the clinical trials and research around dosage. It's like, well, you know, if I was going to take a dose of MDMA with my partner, right, to work on our relationship or our marriage, like, you know, what would that be? Like, well, in, you know, in clinical trials, you know, this is the dose that's being used, and, you know, you can share that kind of information. It's not necessarily, prescriptive, but if there's data out there that can help someone, you know, reduce a risk and maximize a potential benefit, then why would we not share that?
Totally. So that's kind of the preparation phase. I would think that there's something around intentions. Maybe you mentioned that, but can you say a little bit more about the process of setting intentions and why it's relevant?
Yeah, well, you have to have an idea of where you want to go. I think one of the really interesting things about psychedelics, psychedelic experiences, non-ordinary states in general is they open things up and they create opportunity. They're not necessarily going to give you the end point and do all of the work, mm-hmm. right? So you need a bit of a direction. Mm-hmm. It's very, it's exciting to have that opportunity, right? Yes. To have that kind of freedom. But if you create that freedom without a plan, you could be a little bit vulnerable, mm-hmm. or, you know, privy to going down some avenue that isn't going to be particularly helpful. So that's really what an intention is. And it's important to distinguish an intention from an expectation, right? I think sometimes people go into that as like, well, you know, my intention with this experience is to heal all of my trauma. And that can be okay, but checking kind of the emotional sort of like link to that intention, how you're sort of thinking about it. Like, is it an aspiration? Is it something that you have a really earnest intent and motivation to move towards and work on? Or is it something you hope you're going to get for free? You know?
F-R-E.
Yeah. Yeah. Because it does. It takes work.
Yeah. Okay. So at the risk of, you know, losing our thread here, because, you know, I want to go a little deeper into that. Hopefully I can steer us back on track here. But it's interesting because people, you know, a lot of people are hearing about psychedelics because of the clinical trials. And the clinical trials sound like your typical drug discovery process. There's a new medication for mental health issues, and you take a medication, and then something happens in the middle there, and then, you know, significant number of people feel better, like 2/3 of people no longer meet criteria for PTSD, for example. So what is it about the psychedelic experience that does require this direction, that does require integration? Like, what's going on that it's not as simple of like a simple thing as just like tweaking some knobs in your brain chemistry so you feel better? What is this thing about like creating some freedom, or we talk about psychedelics as a catalyst. What the hell does all that mean?
Yeah, good question. Well, I would say that it means that the mind and the body are not separate, and that the even the mind and body of one individual is not really separate from other individuals and relationships that they're in, and that those collections of relationships are not separate from communities, which are not separate from larger kind of ecosystems, and that, you know, forgive the cliche, but that we're all connected. I mean, maybe that's a kind of an obtuse way to answer your question.
Yes.
But, you know, things are not these little discrete isolated machines that you can go in and tweak a knob and then you leave it. And it's like, everything is connected to everything else somehow. So so let me back up for a second.
Yes.
Maybe this is a good way to sort of approach like what I see happening in the psychedelic experience. And it can be useful to frame it in terms of thinking about why a lot of people do come to it, who are, you know, looking for relief, right? The clinical trials are exploring how to heal or solve like obvious issues or problems, mm-hmm. right? That are, like I mentioned before, things like depression, anxiety, PTSD, mm-hmm. right? So one of the ways to think about a lot of those issues, and, you know, would not be the first to sort of to point this out, is to conceive of them as kind of forms of like rigidity mm-hmm. or sort of like a mental, like a fixated way of viewing and relating to the world, right? So you're kind of stuck in a pretty narrow box and feel a little trapped, mm-hmm. right? So with depression, you are kind of like ruminating and stuck in a particular narrative, something that's happened to you in the past or some kind of like current situation. Don't feel like there's any way out. Addiction, similarly, right? Like repeating the same, kind of like the same behaviors, even though it's sort of increasingly doing damage to your life or in a way that, you know, that is problematic for you. So all of these kind of afflictions have that similar flavor. And I'm not a neuroscientist, but, you know, the as far as I understand, the kind of neurological associations with these conditions kind of tend to reflect that, right?
Like, I'll just say, yeah. We've had Judson Brewer on the podcast, right. And he's done an amazing job of articulating the neurobiological processes behind addictions to substances like cigarettes or cocaine or even food, yeah. And also that similar mechanisms are in place, accounting for internalizing problems like anxiety and mood problems. It's all this stickiness or this tendency to lock into patterns, some of which are unhealthy, and we just get stuck in these feedback loops. Right. So there is a tendency in our brain to sort of like fade into order, and sometimes too much order of some kind.
Correct. So too much order, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Too much structure, too narrow. Mm-hmm. So what psychedelics do or can do, and you know, it's worth mentioning not just psychedelics, but other altered or non-ordinary states mm-hmm. of consciousness mm-hmm. that can be, you know, achieved by various other means. We could talk about some of that a little bit later, is really open the system up, right? So they create connections between parts of the brain that don't typically converse, you know, or may not have conversed since early childhood or since a traumatic experience, for example, right? So things get... When we're stuck or things are narrow, things have been really compartmentalized yeah. in our internal system. Yeah. Psychedelics just open that system up. They don't necessarily rewire and fix the system, right? Because what does fix mean? Like, do we have an actual like conventional sense of like, this is healthy, this is well, this is fixed, this is in balance, and this is unwell? It's easier to say, okay, well, this is unwell because I'm suffering, this yeah. hurts, right? Yeah. But even then there's forms of suffering that, you know, may just be part of our human experience and that yeah. can't really be quote unquote fixed, you know. Yeah. So yeah. it's another nuance there that maybe we could go into later, but so psychedelics really open this system up and create the opportunity for new connections to be made, yeah. for being able to see things in new ways, yeah. see solutions to problems that didn't seem to be there before. And yeah, so that's really that's what we're talking about. We're sort of opening the system up, but that's just kind of the start, right? Then it's like, once the system is opened up, yeah. then what do you do?
I love the fact that now opening the system up is not just a metaphor, mm-hmm. right? This thing about like making new connections is not just a metaphor. And I'll refer people to the picture that circulated a lot, including
placebo and the psilocybin. Yeah.
Exactly. So I think it's Robin Carhart Harris's work that shows the connections among various brain regions in a brain that is on placebo. And it's there, you know, a small number of like of connections, some of which are quite thick, representing, you know, a sort of neural highway where a lot of information passes, and then a brain that's under the influence of psilocybin, where there are very few of those neural highways and tons and tons and tons of like thinner connections between brain regions that haven't been communicating before. So not just a metaphor, this is actually happening in your brain, changing the way regions in the brain connect to each other. So all this potential, all this freedom, all this flexibility.
You're making me think of like a city or a community
yes.
whose like environs and like outer reaches have just been kind of destroyed because there's a couple super highways that yes. have just like been placed in there, and the whole like there's this concentrated like downtown core that's like really frenzied, and then this like impoverished kind of like outer region, and then someone does some progressive remodeling of the infrastructure of the community, and it's like no, a lot less cars, more bike paths,
right, walking trails, and yeah totally. So this is cool. I think it opens the some clarity on this idea that intentions help create some direction and some container for working with all of that flexibility and freedom, because it can be overwhelming or chaotic or just not meaningful, which, people who've had bad psychedelic experiences or uncomfortable psychedelic experiences can speak to, that it just feels very chaotic.
Right. Well, this is worth pointing out too, is that like, the structure and the quote unquote rigidity, right?
Yes.
It has utility. It comes from somewhere. I mean, that's how we establish ourselves as conscious, functional beings relating to one another in a kind of dualistic, flesh and blood world, right? We need that. We need that structure too. And as we grow up and sort of prune various kind of neural pathways, I figured that out. I can put that in the automatic system in the background. If you're constantly seeing the connection between everything, that's not super useful either, right? So it's just that when those structures become a little too rigid and too oppressive, that it's worth opening up. But yeah, there's utility to that structure as well.
Right. So this sounds like something that you've been talking a lot about. You wrote about it for the Mindspace blog, this idea of not too tight, not too loose. Can you articulate that for us?
Sure. Yeah. So there's a sutra about the Buddha. I think it's called the Sona Sutra, that I don't remember when I sort of like first heard it or heard some Buddhist kind of teacher talk about it. But it always really stuck out for me kind of intuitively. Maybe I was, working in music for a long time, so it resonated with that. But there was a monk, I think named Sona, who had approached the Buddha. He was like a musician of some kind and played some stringed instrument. It was like something like a lute or something like that. Or I don't know the actual sort of term, and was having really trouble with his meditation practice, and had approached the Buddha for instruction. And the Buddha kind of responded to him saying, well, you're a musician, your instrument, like what happens when you tune your strings like really, really tight, and he's like, well, it doesn't sound good. It's hard to play and you might break a string, it's like, okay, right. So, and what happens if you tune your instrument really, really, really loose? He's like, well, if it's too loose, you can't get any sound out of it, like at all. It's just really sloppy. You can't play. And then he's like, well, there you go. Your meditation practice should really be the same. Mm-hmm. No, not too tight, not too loose. And that always kind of resonated with me, just in practicing anything, finding balance between that sense of like openness and discipline. Being relaxed, but also being alert. And, in a meditation practice or instruction, that's one of the first things a meditation teacher will probably say is like, okay, get into a comfortable position. You want to be relaxed. You're not working too stringently to get towards something, but you don't want to just like space out and, sit back or whatever either. You want to be alert and aware of what's going on. Not too tight, not too loose, really. As I was getting more into sort of psychedelic work and seeing the different directions people could go, it just became a really useful frame for me to think about how we're working with the mind, how we're working with these experiences. There is a lot of emphasis right now on how tight the world is and how tight, folks who, as we were just discussing, with various sort of mental health issues are, if that is a form of kind of mental rigidity and tightness. And so I think that's one of the reasons that psychedelics are seeing so much attention now, renewed attention, is because they're amazing loosening mechanisms, mm-hmm. right? They can really open the system up, as we said, which is great. But I also think that that there's a risk there too that is a little underexamined, maybe as a result of potentially being overblown in the 60s and 70s, right, when there was this sort of political reaction to what was going on. It's like, oh, we don't want things loosening up, and war on drugs, and Nixon cracked down on all the, you know, and the research shutting down and everything like that. But I do think it's real that, you know, sometimes people will have a taste of healing or have a taste of that opening with a psychedelic experience and be like, great, oh, this is amazing. I can heal myself, you know, or I can become enlightened, or I can see what's really going on. And I don't think there's a bottom to that,
right?
I don't think you're ever going to solve the paradox of being human, like being embodied in this world, right?
And having to function in it.
I think the moment of enlightenment is the same as the moment of death, and it's the same as kind of madness too, right? So, and you know, obviously there has been, you know, historically talk of that risk of sort of psychosis or something with psychedelics. I think, you know, the actual risks of that are very, very small, but I think, and I'm not sure it's a super helpful frame. I mean, obviously folks with and clinical trials do the screening, and that will continue to be the case for, you know, medical interventions, et cetera. And, you know, if there is a family history of schizophrenia or psychosis, you know, it's important for people to know that that's something that should be considered. But I think a more useful framing just for a wider audience is like, just watch for like what you're trying to achieve here, right, and like what's useful for you. Right. Like where do you want to get to? What are your values? What do you value? What about your relationships? What about your family? What about systems in the world? You know, if you start to unpack and undo every opposition or kind of like every structure without intention, you can find yourself a little bit flailing or lost at sea, right? And that's really where integration comes in.
That's really cool. I'll just add one piece, even though you covered it so well. On a bit more of a micro scale, I've just seen in like my own free experience as a therapist, as an integration therapist, the sense of like the tremendous relief and inspiration from the release one gets from a psychedelic journey when one is feeling uptight for whatever reason. And then thinking like, wow, this is it. This is what I need to be well. And then I'm going to do that again. And it's like, whoa, 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 that wasn't the same thing, right? I don't feel that same release. It's like, what is this chaotic, you know, ego-dissoluting experience that I'm like completely lost in? That's not what happened last time, right? So it gets complex quickly. But that for some people, that first release can be really powerful, and like people are going to want to go back to it. So yeah, I love this notion that there's kind of no bottom. And one needs to be really careful. And, you know, again, sort of getting coaching on that or just looking out for it as one is navigating their own psychedelic experiences.
There's no bottom and there's no ceiling really either, right? This is what I was saying before about how contextual this work is. You know, someone may have layers of trauma or just layers of stuff relating to sort of their identity and who they are. And, you know, you have an experience and it's really useful in the moment and you want to go back to it because you think you're going to get the same thing. But hold on, you've just changed your system.
Right.
Right. So has that landed? Have you integrated that? Have you like, how is your system reoriented since you've been through that?
Yes.
And then if you just like, you go and hit it again, you're like, wait a second. I wasn't done rebuilding the foundation, or I wasn't done, you know, it's like doing a lot of remodeling at the same time.
Well, that's interesting. I think this is a nice way for us to get back on track to the original thread. I think we've covered the psychedelic experience to some extent. We've covered the prep and the intention setting. There's the sense that the psychedelics open things up, create degrees of freedom, create potential, etc. And then there's a remodeling phase, which is an interesting metaphor for it. Is that to suggest that things, maybe even sort of like the neurochemical balance in our brains and in our ecosystems and whatnot, kind of like tend back towards order And the integration process is sort of like guiding that or shaping it in some way. Like, take us through, like, we've got the opening, and then what is the integration process, and where does it go? How does it land?
Right. Yeah. Good question. So, in terms of things tending back to order, my inclination there is, probably. If you've got a system that's been like doing the same thing over and over for 10 or 15 years, where it's like, this is the behavior, or this is the this is the habit, this is the automatic pilot doing its thing, and maybe you kind of unwind it and everything like that, and there's this neuroplastic window where that tendency doesn't return. But if you don't really do anything to harness that, and then you're this individual or this organism or system then returns to an environment that is the same as it was before, relating to others in the same way as it did before, that habit is probably still in there somewhere, that sort of that muscle memory or whatever. So tending back to order seems likely to me, without knowing, again, necessarily being able to explain the neurological kind of correlate there. That said, there's a lot that can be done to harness those moments of neuroplasticity, or harness those open moments to kind of rewire things. And you know, this is where more, I'm calling like conventional behavior change therapy, something like CBT, for example, like suddenly has this new utility. So whereas someone who may have like been trying to change behavior for a long time and doing CBT with the therapist and like maybe having some success, but kind of getting stuck, or maybe not having any at all. And suddenly there's a real window to be able to use some of those tools, right? To say, okay, well, watch what's happening, right? Like, do you see that pattern? Are you noticing that thing? It's like, try something different here. Try something different again, right? So you're training the mind to move in a new direction. And this isn't new either, right? In terms of pairing pairing an experiential practice with a more sort of like cognitive one. So, you know, you go back to like mind training or Lojong in Tibetan Buddhism, that's like meditation practice, and then those kinds of exercises to watch for the habits, the behaviors, etc. So, you know, therapy is a great example of something that can be done in integration work, is to go in and, okay, the system's been opened up. Now, where do you want to go? What was the thing that was the problem before? What was that problem connected to? What ideas, what relationships, right? What obligations, what values? And then how are you going to restructure that? What's the plan? But that's just one thing. That's like maybe a very like obvious thing that, you know, people think about integration therapy. That would maybe be the first place someone goes, like, okay, well, for integration, I'm going to see my therapist or my coach, right? Which I think is a great example. But I think integration work really exists like on a spectrum, a lot of different practices. And that they run from very cognitive on the one end to very experiential on the other. And we could sort of run through some of those if you want. And again, this has to do really with the, like, where the individual is at, like the context, right? So this is not just, so what's so interesting about this work is like it is really important for someone to understand where they are, or to have the support, either peer support or therapist or whoever it is that's got a sense of where someone is landing coming out of these experiences. Because
what does that mean? What does that mean, where they're landing?
Well, different people need different things, right? And so you may have someone, for example, that has an experience with psilocybin or LSD, and they have a really neat, tidy arc, right? They go through the experience where they maybe have a rocky kind of come up and reckoning, you know, as the drug is coming on, and maybe there's some kind of like crisis and some insight, and then an emotional sort of release, a somatic release, and a real sense of like relief and a denouement, and then calm, lucidity, insight, renewed motivation. Great. I mean, that's kind of like an maybe an ideal scenario. And it does happen, mm-hmm. right? Where folks come out of that and, you know, their lives are changed. Great. I mean, if that happens, great. But someone may also have an experience with, you know, ayahuasca, or, and this can happen with any substance, right? 5-MeO-DMT or, you know, psilocybin, and just kind of have things blown open and be a kind of a wreck on the other side of it. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean it didn't work, mm. right? That just means you're somewhere different in that whole arc and that whole process. Mm-hmm. So people can be at much very different sort of stages mm. of what I'd call that kind of like psychedelic experience integration mm. arc. And really integration is about figuring out, okay, well, where are you at? Like, what happened? Mm. Where do you want to be? And like, what can we do to facilitate that?
Okay. So this is getting a little trippy here in yeah. the sense that I think again, in conventional thinking about the psychedelic like treatments that right. we're hear about in the clinical trials and the media and stuff, the assumption is that there's a fairly linear arc. Mm. Although, you know, let's say the MAPS studies, for example, three dosing sessions with integration in between, we all know that, you know, those dosing sessions aren't linear. It's not linear within the three, right. within the three dosing sessions and integration mm-hmm. phases. But again, the narrative is, at the end of that, most people are healed. Okay, so that there's an arc. What you're saying now is that maybe the arc, if there is an arc, a full arc, maybe it plays out over one journey. Maybe it plays over three journeys. Maybe it plays out over even longer than that. And so sometimes part of integration is actually going back to a psychedelic experience. Or maybe part of an arc is like staying away from it for a bit. So what exactly is this arc? And like, how is that playing out? It's like, we're not just talking about, you know, a psychedelic experience anymore. What the hell's going on?
Well, yeah, but maybe it goes on for the rest of your life. You know what I mean? It's like,
too loose, Andrew.
It's like, what do you want? Where do you want to be? Well, you know? Okay, Yeah, and I think also, like, you know, you're pointing to the research or clinical trials. It's like, those also, like, they need to be very explicit mm. and limited for the purposes of, you know, data collection and validation and, like, okay, this is where we're drawing the line. And yes, those people meet these requirements. So, but I'm sure, you know, you'd hear that there's folks who have come out of MAPS at varying levels of betterment or wellness, some who could have potentially used more mm-hmm. experiential work, etc. But I guess to get back to your
I still feel it's like a little bit too loose in the sense that, you know, like if people want to have intentions and yeah. want to like have some sense of like what they're getting themselves into with yeah. a psychedelic journey, it yeah. suddenly got super complicated because like, I just want to try psilocybin or I'm feeling a little bit like, you know, tangled up in something difficult that happened to me 2 years ago. Right. Now you're saying, well, maybe it's one, maybe it's a lifetime worth of like, what the hell is that?
Well, you know, I think like, look, we're looking for the best possible outcomes, mm-hmm. right? And setting people up for success. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying, well, it could be amazing or it's just going to totally ruin everything. Mm-hmm. I'm saying the more awareness you can have about sort of like where you're at and mm-hmm. where you want to be, mm-hmm. the easier it'll be to kind of identify what kind of tools and what kind of integration practices might be helpful uh-huh. for you, right? So, and you can experiment. And so maybe this is like an appropriate time to just like talk about what some of those might be.
Yeah, you're
like,
that's right.
I gave an example of like one end of the spectrum in terms of like doing therapy, like doing talk therapy, CBT or whatever, you know. But I think on the other end of the spectrum, for example, you have some people might benefit coming out of a psychedelic experience with, you know, touching back in on like some non-ordinary states. So things like breath work or maybe even sort of meditation.
Non-ordinary states of consciousness, right?
Non-ordinary states of consciousness, right? So some people may benefit from like, okay, I'm going to actually go back there and tap back into
right.
some of that experience. Like that can be an integration practice, yeah. right? For others, movement, you know, yoga or even just like exercise, running, martial arts, engaging with the body may right. be a practice that could be helpful for them. For others, sort of creative creative practices, journaling, sketching, right? Could be useful. And these kind of exist on a spectrum in terms of things that may be grounding or things that may be loosening, right? Tight. So it's not that you're flipping a switch, but like there is this kind of idea that like, okay, the knobs have been turned and now we're kind of like fine-tuning them. And there's a lot of different tools we can use to do that. And I think it's about like figuring out like, well, what resonates with you? Where are you at? What's helpful?
Yes.
Right. And a little bit of trial and error there. Yeah. So it's not so much that like, okay, where are you on this arc, and did it go right or did it go wrong? What do you do? It's more like, no, okay, let's refine it. Like you've been through this thing. Hopefully there is some opening. There is some context here where you're in a better position than you were before relative to where you want to be, what matters to you. And how can we just make the most of that, lay the foundations for other like future work, whether or not that involves doing psychedelics again ever at all. Yeah. Right.
You know, one thing that I think might be clarifying here is, and I'm even sort of cringing that I'm about to say it and that it's helpful, is this notion of the inner healing intelligence. Okay. Because I think that's the best we have so far in terms of understanding what this notion of the arc is in the first place. Okay. So, and I'll just really briefly give some context, and maybe you can speak to how you relate to that metaphor. You know, sometimes people will talk about the analogy to like, if someone goes into the emergency room with a broken arm, what the doctors do is just like set the bone and put on a cast, and the healing happens in the body. The body knows how to repair a broken bone. And so in principle, the same is true of like a mental or emotional trauma. The best we can do as like humans and as therapists is to set the right conditions, and the body will heal itself even on a mental or an emotional level. And so there is some, I don't know if it's some kind of intelligence or there's some kind of force or energy or whatever, but there is something driving the system forward. And that is, even if it's nonlinear, even if it's painful, there is some energy or momentum moving the human mind and body towards healing, towards wholeness or something like that. And so that's, I think, actually a helpful mindset even for people to bring into their journeys, because there is some meaning or order driving the process at some level. Wonder how you relate to that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're referring to obviously this sort of centerpiece of the MAPS MDMA for PTSD protocol. And I do believe in a kind of trend towards balance. I think things get more complex when you're talking about psychological or mental well-being, because it's also where we connect to others.
Mm.
Right? Mm-hmm. So I do think there's a sense that yes, you can kind of trust that if you have that intention and you have these tools and you have that support, that over time you'll probably come into a better place or a less unwell place.
And let me just say, I don't think we need psychedelics to flesh out this metaphor of the inner healing intelligence, because as therapists, we see it all the time. People want to get better. People are motivated. There are things getting in the way, but and in many cases, people have an intuition about what they need. Same with mindfulness meditation. And the inner healing intelligence type of framing comes up in, you know, things like mindfulness-based stress reduction as well. It's like create space for yourself and things emerge. Clarity emerges, and that clarity, you know, what is it? Clear vision leads to wise action kind of thing. So create space for yourself and your body, and clarity will emerge on how to proceed towards higher states of wellness or wisdom or insight or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. I do think that coming back to my point before, the difference here is that, you know, how we define well-being can be more challenging if you're thinking about it in that emotional or psychological context versus in a kind of broken bone kind of way.
Okay.
Because I think it's really wrapped up in relationship and right. in family and in community. So it's hard to isolate, like, you know, an individual may kind of go through this process who's sort of suffered and had issues related to, I don't know, childhood trauma or, you know, family issues, whatever it is, may come through that and heal something, right? And then they may, you know, come back into the world and be faced with relationships that have not had that same experience, mm-hmm. right? And that kind of challenge that balance or well-being, and you're faced with this, the prospect of either then like sharing that wisdom or sharing that healing and being able to hold and facilitate the well-being of others whom you care about or who you're connected to, mm-hmm. or in the other direction, being like not being able to and kind of regressing,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I do think there's an inner healing intelligence there, but I don't think it can just exist in isolation in, you know, inside.
Sure.
Like we're connected.
So this is, you know, this can get really abstract and spiritual quickly,
mm-hmm.
because what are we healing? Right. And
I'm not into abstract spiritual stuff.
Right. Not at all. Right. Who or what exactly are we healing, right? So someone goes through MDMA assisted psychotherapy for PTSD and, you know, builds these very strong relationships with the therapist or therapists providing the treatment. But, you know, are they, if they're going back into a traumatizing environment, maybe the healing involves healing that environment as well. And then for that environment to be healed, what else do we need to cover?
Right.
And what exactly is this psychedelic healing project we're engaged in?
Right.
And yet, it does seem to be fitting into a traditional kind of drug discovery, you know, biomedical health science framework, mm-hmm. right? It is, in principle, going to arrive as a treatment for these things. And maybe that's enough. Maybe it's a good enough fit that it is actually going to help people. And we don't need to heal the world for people to benefit from these treatments.
I think all of those can coexist,
mm-hmm.
right? I think the biomedical model is doing what it does and its sort of existing paradigm mm-hmm. and system, and it's slow moving, but more people are getting access. You know, ketamine-assisted psychotherapy is reaching more folks, and you know, hopefully MDMA and psilocybin will follow, and there'll be programs where people can get the treatment that they need.
Mm-hmm.
But it's far from, you know, healing the world.
Yeah.
And yeah, there's a certain hubris to that as well, mm-hmm. right? I do think that's one reason that like a harm reduction integration programs are important, because in the meantime, people are accessing
yes.
these medicines themselves, and, you know, ayahuasca, peyote, psilocybin, sort of like traditional indigenous use, various sort of populations around the world, like they've been baked into communal
yes.
Healing processes for a very long time.
Yes.
And even outside of that context, more folks are, you know, accessing psilocybin, increasingly decriminalized, and, you know, seeing something similar happening with it. In Canada has happened with cannabis, you know, mm-hmm. and I think that's important.
Yeah.
I think it's important. So I think all of those things can coexist,
yeah.
and should, and that the education around it
yes.
is why it's what the education around it becomes kind of so important in term. And, you know, what, like getting back to the other point
yes.
about, maybe we should like heal like a family, or like
yes.
I think it's very true. Like, and there has been, you know, work, MDMA work, pre-criminalization, like family therapy with MDMA,
mm-hmm.
and just like group work in general. Like healing doesn't happen.
And the couples, the research on the couples therapy that's
yep.
happening right now.
Absolutely. So And then you can see very quickly then, like, from there, how people start to get ambitious and start being like, well, maybe we can, like, it's true, we're connected. And the, you know, I'm in pain because, you know, my parents were in pain, or because my family's, like, hurt. My family's hurt because of this community issue. And this entire community, or this, you know, entire population is hurt because of this colonial issue of, like, you know, and it's, like, that's real. And the question then is, like, you see the potential to sort of, like, well, for one thing, you know, and this is, there's a very big thrust to this in the psychedelic community, is, like, a lot of the source of this stuff comes from these systemic things, right?
What does that mean?
Well, I mean, you can't isolate, for example, all of this, like, pain with respect to the indigenous populations in Canada from genocide, right? And, like, the just the wide scale trauma, that trickles down, you know, generation to generation and manifests in different ways. And then you see, you know, it's an individual on the street who's, you know, suffering from alcoholism. It's like, well, how do we treat this person, right? So of course, like, there's this ambition to address these systemic issues, and it's understandable that folks see a lot of potential for psychedelics to do this. And yet at the same time, it's like, we're trying to get from treating an individual to, like, okay, can we treat a family?
Right.
What does that look like? Right. And then it's like, okay, how do we treat a whole, you know, that's not viable. So I think the sort of just systemic analysis of what's going on and politically is just, like, is important. Yeah. I'm not sure that's the, like, psychedelics can do that, but, you know, that's also where you get the old cliche of putting, like, LSD in the water, which is
didn't work out so well.
Well, you know, not a great idea. So yeah, I think all of those threads can coexist and complement one another.
I think a nice place to sort of get back on our thread here is the fact that the free program that we have is going to be offering groups. Okay, to come back to this range of tools for integration. Yep. And maybe you've already covered it, but I don't know if there's more to say about why we're offering groups and what the potential is.
Well, I mean, like I said before, like, I don't think healing happens in a vacuum. I think there's a lot that can be done with group peer support for well-being. I mean, we know this from mindfulness programs. Mm-hmm. It's like, people need feel connected to one another, and they can learn from one another. It's more accessible, so you can get, like, you can amplify the sort of the therapeutic benefit of psychedelic experiences and of you know, psychoeducation and therapy in general by connecting people to a group who are going through the same thing. So if you can amplify the efficacy and you can reach more people and make it more accessible, why wouldn't you? You know, I mean, that's kind of the simple answer there.
What about how fragile and vulnerable people can be coming out of a psychedelic experience? And then you're throwing into a room with, like, 8, 12, 15 other people.
Yeah.
And it's like, I don't know if I can handle all that.
Sure. Yeah.
Stimulation, all that, you know, preoccupation with being judged, right, or, you know, who are these people? And right. Yeah.
Well, you know, I think that also depends on who's facilitating. So who's, you know, who's holding the space. You know, that term is kind of a little overused in the psychedelic world, but it holds some relevance sometimes. It's like, how is communication being facilitated? What are the ground rules, you know? But I think, like, this gets back to a not too tight, not too loose thing, where it's like, in order to be connected, you need to have a certain amount of vulnerability, right? So you gotta let the walls down, you know. And there's it's hard, it's hard to do that, but there's it's a risk reward thing, right? Sometimes you need to put walls up, like, that's what, you know, boundaries are for. Everyone's all about, like, I need my, like, establishing my boundaries. It's like, great, you need to do that. You need to have those there for you to feel safe. You know what you need. Awesome. Okay, so maybe groups aren't for everyone, right? Or maybe there's someone in the group that triggers you, and it doesn't, like, how do you sort of navigate that situation? But at the same time, it's like, if you can let some walls down, right? If you can be vulnerable, that's the window for connection. Mm-hmm. And then you have to reckon with, like, okay, I'm letting someone in and someone else is letting me in. Mm-hmm. So that can get messy, mm-hmm. right? But if we can hold that, we can be stronger.
Right.
And that's the same, you know, same thing in the brain. Same thing when you're letting those walls down and letting those places connect that have been compartmentalized because of trauma or whatever.
I want to come back to, maybe we can call it like integration therapy. Mm-hmm. And by that, I mean, someone gets like really blown open by a psychedelic experience. Maybe they took too high a dose. Maybe their set and setting wasn't adequately addressed. Maybe it was all perfect, but it was just like, you know, the mushroom gave them what they needed, which was to get blown open, whatever that means. Mm-hmm. And they come out of there just feeling really raw, really fragile. And so you did talk about different tools that are, you know, that they can avail themselves of, but I wonder how you just think about, or how you would talk to someone who really needs to sort of get back, to get some of those walls back or to get back to a more functional place when they're feeling really fragile. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good question. Well, I mean, I think time is just one of them, mm. right? Mm. So someone may need to get those walls back, but you can't necessarily force them back into mm-hmm. shape, mm-hmm. right? So the most important thing would be just to ensure that they're supported and have access, right? Mm-hmm. So this is where integration can be quite different than conventional like therapy.
Yep.
You know, when someone goes through the MAPS protocol and coming out of, you know, an MDMA experience, the therapists are basically on call
right.
and available
right.
as needed, as they're kind of reassembling.
Right.
So that kind of needs to be there, mm-hmm. right?
Even for people doing it recreationally, the potential for the need to be rebuilt is still there.
Yeah. And maybe that's not a therapist. Maybe it's a friend. Maybe it's a family member, mm-hmm. you know, but, that's why doing some preparation, having some space on the other side is important.
Yes.
If you've got to go right back into a big presentation at work mm-hmm. or a big mm-hmm. family event mm-hmm. or, you know what I mean? Like that can be hard mm-hmm. for sure. So, but you know, getting back to that kind of inner healing intelligence, I think it also kind of, it goes in the other direction too. It's like, don't, you know, your ego and your kind of system will start to build something back up. Mm-hmm. And if you are feeling really raw, you know, maybe what's needed is to feel really raw for a few days
yeah.
and to have that held and validated yeah. by someone else or, you know, community or family or whatever yeah. it is.
I'm still a little dissatisfied by...
Of course you are.
by some of the language here. And it might just be that you've seen enough variety that to really speak to it in its essence, you have to stay abstract because it's so much depends on the person and the context and all this kind of stuff. But, you know, one of the patterns I've seen is just how disorienting it can be on a psychedelic journey when one's, you know, conventional points of reference fall away. Mm-hmm. And that could be just like my five senses don't work for the, you know, anymore. And will I ever get them back? I can't trust where, you know, what I'm seeing or like my senses are like, who am I? You know, some kind of like ego dissolution experience where I don't know who I am. I don't know where I am. Very, very destabilizing. Right. Or just encountering, you know, like seeing something, a memory or an insight into something that's been going on in one's life that is like really hard to see and hold. All these things can make someone, yeah, take away the reference points and the guideposts in their life that keep them functioning. Maybe it's the sort of order piece that we were talking about before. So yes, time is, you know, there's something about the sort of like the ego and the sense of order does crawl its way back in over time. But losing one's sense of self and one's orientation in life can make people suffer a lot, right? And so just what are your thoughts on finding those points of reference again, or those sure. those directions?
Well, I mean, there's two threads or two ways I kind of want to answer this sort of set of questions. I mean, one, just to immediately respond to that, is like, in some ways, that's a feature, not a bug, mm-hmm. right? If someone is going mm-hmm. into this looking to lose a certain part or to reintegrate a certain part that's been kind of isolated from the rest, like, that's what they're going for. So that's where kind of the preparation, the intention setting comes in. We're having a sense of like, okay, what are the values? What are the relationships that are important? And then, of course, you know, you may discover something along the way that shifts that. But I guess the question is like, what are the tools, or how do you support someone through that? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's not obvious. I think that trying to work through, I mean, this is where doing some of that values-based work is really interesting. So I know, you know, the psilocybin protocols that use an acceptance commitment therapy model for folks can be a helpful sort of way to look at it. So anything that is going to connect people to or reconnect them to, you know, how they see the world, how they want to see the world, and the folks around them is relevant there. I think the other thing to say, to sort of speak to the earlier part of the question, is, you know, it is possible to kind of like get things a little bit more fragmented. You're sort of alluding to like, my senses are kind of like messed up, and I'm just reminded of some of the narratives like coming out of the mindfulness space and the work of like Willoughby Britton and her partner Jared Lind, all around sort of these adverse experiences in sort of intense meditation. You know, there's another article I think that was published this week by an MBSR teacher, a mindfulness practitioner, that had like a crack up on retreat that really kind of destabilized them. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, same can happen with psychedelics. Anything that's really sort of going deep into the non-ordinary states can, things can get shaken up. And there are tools, or there are sort of like support networks out there for folks. And I think Willoughby Britton's Cheetah House is a good reference for folks who maybe wanting to look for some resources there. But to me, like the grounding piece there is time and support from folks who kind of like understand where you're at, who you were, mm-hmm. who you want to be, mm-hmm. and letting things kind of reemerge. That people do tend to come back to baseline. But again, this is why having a plan and having that kind of support is important. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think it's worth saying that most people don't have those mm-hmm. experiences. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'll say I've learned, I think, over the years, that people underestimate how disruptive psychedelic experiences can be, in the sense that, yes, they can be healing, but they sort of break things down before anything gets built back up in a new and better way. And so people need to be informed of that disruption. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it might last a few hours, it might last a few weeks, but it's going to break things down before things get built back up again.
Or it might not. Sometimes it doesn't, you know. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, you know, they all have sometimes people have fun experiences and feel very similar the next day mm-hmm. too. Mm-hmm. I think it's just worth highlighting that that's also possible, mm-hmm. you know.
Okay, so number of references to mindfulness. We're both MBSR teachers, and I think it's a big part of how I, and I suspect you, approach integration, and I would say even navigating psychedelic experiences. How do you think about sort of the marriage of these two kind of lineages and these two tools? There is a kind of wisdom in the psychedelic community around, like, you know, principles and tools for experiencing things. I think, for example, you know, this sort of basic principle, like if something shows up in your experience or when you're on a psychedelic, it's important to try to approach or at least be with that experience, develop a sense of curiosity and interest in it as opposed to resisting it, right? Which of course will sound very familiar to anybody that's, you know, done any kind of meditation or mindfulness program. So yeah, maybe that as a launching point. How do you think about these two different approaches?
Sure. Well, you know, I think they've kind of coexisted, certainly in kind of the West, for lack of a better term, since the 60s. You know, a lot of the sort of pioneers or leaders of what's become sort of the mindfulness community, certainly in North America, where a number of them are also exposed to psychedelics, LSD, certainly on the West Coast in the 60s and 70s. I think that they've sort of informed one another through the years to a certain extent. But I also, it's interesting, I also think there's still a lot that can be bridged. And that, you know, to the extent that mindfulness has become sometimes a bit of a watered down buzzword and really underestimated and misunderstood in terms of like just how detailed it can be as a practice and just how nuanced and thorough it is in terms of what we're actually talking about and, you know, what we teach in MBSR, both as practitioners and also as facilitators, you know, thinking about inquiry, really breaking down our like understanding the nervous system, the sort of the somatic awareness that's included in that tradition. I think there's still more to like that that psychedelic therapy and psychedelic movement can still learn more and draw more from like really what's been developed in the mindfulness world. Even in more recent years, I think some of the work that our colleague Patricia Rockman and Susan Woods have done is just really amazing and like sort of moving that lineage and tradition forward, and is worth investigating. And similarly, I think, you know, psychedelics are just like an incredible tool to facilitate what, you know, the course of kind of like education and practice that someone might embark on in an MBSR program. I think you've referenced before, can you imagine doing an MBSR and on the retreat weekend having a psychedelic experience, right? And how that could transform that protocol. So yeah, certainly. I mean, there's a lot you'll hear in any kind of conventional sort of talk of like how to work with the psychedelic experience, how to both navigate one and integrate one, and like mindfulness is all over that. But yeah, I think there's lots there that can still be fleshed out.
I'd like to linger there for a minute. Yeah. I want to flesh out, you know, you mentioned inquiry, you mentioned Pat and Susan.
Yeah.
What is inquiry and how does it work in a mindfulness context, and why is it relevant for a psychedelic experience?
Sure.
Or psychedelic integration?
Yeah, putting me on the spot here. I hope I don't disappoint Pat.
Yeah, right. She'll be listening.
A little bit. I've been so focused on my my psychedelic practice, like my MBSR is getting a little rusty. Yeah. No, well, it's a way that a facilitator, or you know, someone who's working with like a practitioner in the space, can inquire or can like tease out someone's experience without leading in any way, right? So it's being very, very non-judgmental, very curious, and helping someone really break down and track their experience of like mindfulness practice or meditation experience, or just like awareness of what's happening in my body, what's happening emotionally, what's happening in my mind. So inquiries, like it's a practice itself, that has to be sort of like very in tune, not looking to get somewhere. So just very, very simple questions that then build, but it's so that the practitioner, in question, can really come to that awareness themselves. Like
this is the person navigating the psychedelic journey.
Yeah.
Right.
Or practicing mindfulness.
Right. So the sitter, the guide, or the integration therapist or coach or whatever can practice this framework or this skill of inquiry.
Yep.
Helping someone like articulate and understand what they've experienced. And the sitter or the coach or whatever is kind of embodying a certain orientation to the, to that person's experience so that they can come to it. They can arrive at clarity and meaning on their own terms. And that I think what's cool about it is that it sort of mirrors what mindful awareness is sort of internally, which I think is also unbelievably valuable, in a psychedelic experience, insofar as if one has the skill to, and you know, the wherewithal, assuming, you know, the drugs have not completely destroyed your sense of self, but the sense of like, okay, my attention is really drawn over here. And as I'm attending over here, there's a lot of thoughts. Those are those thoughts. And maybe, these are interesting thoughts and I want to kind of like see where they take me. And then while I'm attending to these thoughts, what's happening in my body? And what is that telling me? And is there some sort of like feeling tone or like emotion present? I'm doing that. And just like observing this whole unfolding in a way that's getting out of the way. But it is fully present to like, really, to create the potential for integration down the road. So this, like, as you, I think you said, like tracking of these different levels of experience, thoughts, emotions, body sensations, et cetera, action tendencies. Part of what can be really useful about that when an experience is difficult is to say, oh, I'm thinking my, you know, the reliability of my senses will never come back. I'm in this permanent state. This is my brain on drugs, whatever. And it's like, oh, okay. I'm noticing that this, like this thought train is leaving the station and it's really uncomfortable. It's like, what else is going on here? Creating space around that experience. So, as a navigational tool, I think it's just unbelievably valuable. And then if one is able to navigate in that way, it just makes a much richer experience on the other end. The other thing I'll say is sometimes a psychedelic experience can be really informative, can be really valuable. You sort of like opened up this neuroplastic window for a certain period of time. And like, it's kind of heavy. You don't want to do that every day. So you have this like limited time to have these experiences and learn or grow from them. And you want to, if you can, be awake and present and sort of like remember your intentions and your values and where you want to be. And so maybe it's a navigation tool again, but it's about like getting value out of this open window, this potential. I don't know if any of that resonates with you.
I mean, I think what comes to mind for me is that if you are practicing that, you're practicing that mindful awareness, that tracking and that sort of parsing of your experience and your even like awareness of your nervous system and your reactivity, all of those things that are going on in that window where there's just a lot more room.
Yes.
There's a lot more space. So in a mindfulness practice, we're trying to create that space in meditation with breath and slowing down, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Psychedelics kind of will often offer that space up, right? Mm-hmm. If you're then practicing that in that space, it's a lot more likely that it can sort of take root, right? It's like, I remember what it's like to have the space. It's like, now I'm tracking my experience. I can see I'm seeing the thoughts. I'm feeling the thing going on in my body. The emotions happening over here. And there's a lot more room. So when we talk about the circle of awareness in MBSR, right? So there's a ton of space there to be able to parse that. If you're doing that in the experience, then in terms of integration or in terms of that taking root, you come out of the experience and then you're back in your life and you're in an environment or in a situation, a thing that would normally trigger you or that would send you into some sort of automatic pilot reactivity mode that doesn't serve you, right? And lead to some maladaptive coping or whatever it is. Suddenly you're like, oh, I remember. Like, I know how to track this. I see what's going on. And that gap that we want to create to be able to sort of change our behavior and move toward the thing that we know is more beneficial becomes much more possible. Yeah. So it's a marriage kind of made in heaven.
Yeah.
Or hell. shout out to the psychedelic elders and Humphrey Osmond and all the sucks. Like heaven or hell, both possible.
I wonder if we can do one more thing here on the mindfulness piece. Okay. Which is, you mentioned earlier that there's something that we've both seen, indicating that, and I don't want to be disrespectful in any way, but just what's been showing up for us, the sense of like not a full integration of mindfulness practice or a full understanding of how mindfulness can be useful in a psychedelic experience that we've seen in the psychedelic community. And so how do you, again, sort of typically or generally, how do you see mindfulness showing up in the psychedelics community? What is being missed? And what do you think could be, what aspect of the marriage could be reinforced a little bit more?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not sure. I think really inquiry, and yeah. What I was just pointing to is one of the first ones, and particularly in terms of facilitators, in terms of facilitating, you know, there is this sense, you know, to a lot of talk about like having a non-directive approach, in psychedelic therapy and facilitation. But I just think there is a lot of great work that's been done around just how nuanced that is and how much of a skill it really is, and how much of a practice it is
for like the therapist training.
Yeah,
there's an opportunity there.
Yeah,
I'll throw something else out at you. Tell me, you know, how this lands with you. My perception is that mindfulness is often thrown in as like a regulating tool. Mm-hmm. It's like, do some breathing, you know, or like a grounding tool. Notice your body, you know, see if you can kind of like settle back in so we can, you know, go back to whatever it is that we were doing a little bit more focused and centered and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And while mindfulness can be a powerful grounding and regulating tool, that's kind of not the point, right? And I'm much more interested in the capacity that a mindfulness practice creates for being with difficult experiences. Yes. And maybe if one is triggered as a therapist or as a voyager or journey or whatever, having more capacity to be with whatever is showing up is kind of a superpower. For all of this work. I wonder how that lands with you.
And I think in this case, it's not so much that isn't present in the in psychedelic community or in training. I think it's just that often the connection isn't made, that folks don't realize that that's one of the things we're talking about. You know, grounding can be important, but that's not really mindfulness practice. It's mindfulness is like being with what's happening and looking for the edges of the experience, looking for the resistance, looking for the attachment to it, and creating space to get into those weeds and figure out how to work with them. Mm-hmm. I think really the case is folks who don't kind of have that background or that education, MBSR or what have you, just don't know that that's kind of what we're talking about. But I do think, you know, that is one of the first things that any good sort of facilitator will encourage you to do is, you know, whatever's coming up, like, be with it, see what's there. Your resistance is like working with that resistance, finding the edges of it, finding the place where you can actually let those walls down, let it in, let it come up.
I wonder, just to kind of like make the finer point here, what's so bad about resistance, and why is it actually valuable to have the capacity to be with and turn toward in a psychedelic context? I mean,
good question. You know, I think resistance is another way to talk about those walls or those boundaries or those structures. Maybe nothing, but if someone is really suffering or struggling, and in a psychedelic experience or in an altered state, there is something coming up, like in the body or from the nervous system, right, or that feels like it's internal, that feels like some kind of threat or something that we need to resist. If you want to figure out what's going on or get to the other side of that suffering, it might be a good idea to investigate that resistance. And it's not that there's necessarily something wrong. Like, so often, you know, what might happen is that there is this fear or is this resistance to this thing that has been packaged away, and that getting to that, creating enough space or getting to that point where the resistance is actually dropped, it's not so terrible on the other side. Mm-hmm. It might be hard, but it might be incredibly liberating and as well.
My assumption about that, and tell me if you disagree, is that, and we should actually talk about bad trips, so I'm glad this came up, but like what people colloquially know as a bad trip is often a resistance to letting the experience unfold. So a capacity to be with whatever showing up in a psychedelic experience is a nice protective tool to avoid a really harrowing ordeal. Even if, and you can speak to this, even if a harrowing ordeal, it might be exactly what the person needs.
Sure. Yeah. Well, you know, I'm not the only one to sort of to say this, but I don't like labeling trips as good or bad. You know, I think more helpful is like pleasant or blissful versus challenging. On the one hand, I think pleasant trips can be therapeutic and beneficial. I think challenging trips can be therapeutic and beneficial. I think pleasant trips can be not so helpful or beneficial. And I think challenging ones can also be not so pleasant or beneficial, right? Like there's like at least four variables there. and usually a psychedelic experience contains a little bit of all of that,
yep.
Right? So, I mean, that's really how I'd sort of frame that. But certainly, yes, I think that's like a starting point for someone who's coming at this, maybe with not a lot of context, who's like worried about a bad trip, quote unquote, and just letting them understand that, hey, the challenge is related to the resistance and building relationship with that resistance may actually yield an outcome that is really beneficial. And then obviously integration is there on the other side to help make that be the case.
Yeah. Okay. Taking up a lot of your time this morning.
Oh, good.
I got one more question for you.
Okay.
If you don't mind.
Yeah.
Okay. Pretty simple. What's giving you energy these days, or what's exciting for you these days in the psychedelics field?
I'm excited about all of it, really. I'm excited about sort of just the continued development of the biomedical model and seeing that stuff move forward. I'm also excited about how much is happening in decriminalization and being able to do more harm reduction and integration work. I think all of the community stuff that's happening, the stuff I do with Plant Parenthood is really motivating. Seeing sort of parents come to these integration circles, some of whom, you know, their psychedelics have changed their lives and their families or communities, like there's stigma around it and they want to talk about that. But others who have kids or adolescents who are really suffering mm-hmm. with mental health issues and want to know when these kinds of treatments can be available for kids, you know, which is a really sticky topic, but also I think a really relevant one. Where that's going to go in the future and just like how much work we could potentially do to help younger people avoid, you know, spending their late teens and 20s, like really getting more entrenched in serious mental health issues because of like childhood trauma. If that's a possibility, to me, that's just really motivating and exciting. You know, I don't know how long it'll take before we get there, but that's something that's definitely on my mind that hasn't really been, this obviously not as developed as some of the rest of what's mm-hmm. going on. I think the free program is something I'm really, really passionate about, just because we can reach a lot of folks, even if it's just education, mm-hmm. you know. I think that's really important. And similarly, the group work, I think there's a lot of potential there too. Both of those things really speak to access, which is really important to me. Yeah. I'm also in the MAPS MDMA for PTSD training program, and it's been really, really interesting to sort of like kind of finally get on the inside of that after hearing about it for so many years from colleagues and some of the various other work I've done. Learning a lot there and interested in sort of continuing to push forward all the stuff we were talking about in terms of bridging the rich stuff continuing to happen in the mindfulness world and the psychedelic space. I think there's a lot we can do there for both communities to kind of benefit. So looking forward to building on that going into next year too.
Cool.
Yeah.
So Andrew, thanks so much for doing this. That was a lot of fun.
It was. Thanks. Looking forward to hearing it.
All right.
Okay.
Till next time.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Mindspace podcast. I hope it was inspiring. If you feel the world could use a little more Mindspace, please consider supporting the podcast. The best way to do that is to leave a review on the Apple Podcast app or wherever you listen, or share your favorite episode on social media. Thanks and be well.